Hello, friends, and welcome back to yet another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
We have not said those words for such a long time.
Why did I get, like, full body chills?
Because you've just been talking about the crow, that's why.
It's like residual
full body chills.
Chills from... Because we were just talking about the Crow remake that's coming up, which I know is going to be bad, but I can't talk about the Crow without being too much. I still have the adrenaline.
It was the perfect experience for Alice because she did not know that I didn't know anything about the Crow, so she got to explain it to, like, an idiot baby. So you're in your element right now.
Me explaining things to idiot babies. My dream.
Speaking of babies, we are currently with a child.
Yeah, we're not alone. As you may or may not know, I have a dog now. Her name is Peachy. She's absolutely gorgeous, but it does mean there may be some dog-related noise in this recording. If she kicks off or starts padding around, obviously we'll try and cut it, but just please be patient. She's only small. She doesn't understand.
And also, either you accept us at our Peachy or you get to know what page you want.
Love us at our Peachy. No, what would the phrase be?
If you do not love me at my Peachy, you cannot have me at my Peachy.
Dropping bangers.
Yes. Because, I'm really happy that we're back on our bullshit and that the pod is back in some form. We don't know, like, how we're going to be doing it for the rest of our lives, but we just, every time I mention the concept of the pod coming back, people seem to like it. So, here we are.
Here we are. Back in the studio, quote unquote.
Yeah, with Peachy.
With Peachy, our producer.
And one of the reasons that we thought it would be a good time to bring the pod back was because there has been a literary ruckus occurring on the internet.
There's
Everyone's
been
getting involved. I've seen so much chat. I've seen so many little lists. Alice, tell us, what is this inaugural episode of What Page Are You On 2.0?
So, you may or may not know that the New York Times dropped their best books of the 21st century, which was determined by asking over 500 industry professionals, authors, and influencers for their top 10 books published post-2000. And there's been lots of debate over what's missing from the list, whether it's good or bad, whatever. We're going to talk about the debate, but we're also going to share what we would have picked had we been asked to contribute.
Which, shockingly, we were not.
Shockingly, because I'm full of opinions.
Yeah, famously, we have opinions.
So first of all, my first opinion that I want to drop is, I understand, I think the nature of these lists is that they're really fun to pick them apart and look at what's missing, look who's underrepresented, what genres are unrepresented, what books are underrepresented. But the list was determined by an anonymous list of 500 people.
That's a lot of people. Like, that's not just, like, the people that work at the New York Times.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of the conversation about the list has kind of assumed that the New York Times have just come up with it themselves. So I'm curious to know, like, who the 500 were.
Yeah.
Because just because it's 500 people doesn't mean there aren't still biases there, but...
Yeah, and that being, by virtue of being chosen by the New York Times book section, there is not, like, an inherent vibe to those people, or, like, massive gaps in what they read, which clearly, you know, there probably were,
because almost certainly, yeah.
Genre as a concept was very underrepresented.
Yes.
But in general, I found it kind of interesting and thought-provoking to go through the list. I enjoyed it.
I will say as well, though, there were a lot of books that I just hadn't heard of, which made me feel like a silly baby.
Interesting.
I don't feel vulnerable enough to tell you what I hadn't heard of, but just there were a few.
Will you tell me in the pub?
Yeah, but I have to pull the list up because I literally cannot remember any of them.
That's fine. I'll wait. I can wait for you to pull the list up on your phone.
Yeah, I mean, just, I guess, like, 100 books is a lot. And obviously the list does skew very American.
Yes.
And generally, obviously, very big as well. Like, by virtue of being selected, I guess they're all, like, pretty big titles. So I was surprised there were so many that just had passed me by entirely. I assume that most of the books I hadn't heard of were potentially published pre-2010-ish. Because I think that's really when I started properly paying attention to contemporary publishing, was like when I became a bookseller,
yes.
Which was around then.
Yes, interesting thought. Yeah, I wonder at what point in my life I started thinking about books as an adult, like post-university. But yeah, you're right that, yeah, there was like a whole decade plus where we weren't like consciously paying attention and books were probably getting published. I really enjoyed the list. It had a lot of bangers on it. I was surprised at how many I had read. But I was also kind of surprised, not surprised, but like, it was very, very American. very, very written in the English language for the most part. Very light on genre. But that's, you know, those are just, that's just how it be. That's fine. Whatever. Like, that was the list.
How many had you read?
I had read 22.
That's an impressive number.
I was shocked. I was quite shocked that I'd read that many. How many did you read?
So, my official count was 17. But then I realized that I counted How to Be Both by Ali Smith because I read that title and thought Girl Meets Boy.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure there was another one that was just there. I don't remember. I think I just hit by mistake. So I think my official number is 15.
Still good.
I think respectable.
Yeah, 100%. Any number is respectable. We do not care. This is just for chat. This is just for chat purposes. Yeah. So we have separately constructed our own little listicles for your listening pleasure. Do you have yours to hand, my friend?
I have mine to hand. Also, we have compared notes, and I believe we only have one title in common.
We only have one title in common. I think we have at least one author in common, but different books, which is quite nice and fun. I was really interested by the title that we had in common because I didn't know you liked it that much.
I knew immediately that we would have that one. That
interesting.
One in
I don't know what, yeah. Let's begin.
I feel
there.
Like we've talked about it on the pod.
Yeah, I don't know. I just felt like it was something that I would, you know, say is like in my top three all-time favourite books. And I didn't know that you liked it that much.
Well, it contains like at least two things that I love. Books about murder. There's a murder in it. And the 90s club scene.
Yeah, you do love that. The bit that you think of as being the book is so different to the bit that I think of as being the book. Wait, obviously, it is all the book, but...
No, but... Yeah, we should say what the book is.
The book is What I Loved by Siri Hustvedt.
So the first chunk is the bit that I remember most. Mm. And I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't read it, but the first chunk of the setup, so it's about this guy and his partner, and they live in New York, and they have a son, and that's all I really want to say. The kind of main plot of the book is about his relationship to his neighbor's son? Matthew.
So it's about this guy who Alice has just described.
Wait, you know, we should just start that again because I did a terrible job.
Yeah. So What I Love by Siri Hustvedt is a sort of multi-part book about the life of this guy who is not in himself like the most exciting guy. But it's about like his...
We're trying to nutshell this book. We're only on the first book and we've already spent so long trying to figure out how to describe the plot and getting it wrong. Maybe we shouldn't nutshell every book. We'll just say that it's set in New York in the 90s. It's about a man and his relationship, platonic relationship with a much younger older teenage boy, right? That's kind of the base premise of the novel.
I don't think that's the base premise of the novel at all.
Wait, really? What do you think is the base premise?
I think it's about like the art world stuff. Friendship with the artist, his friend Bill, Bill's relationship with Violet, who is his second wife.
I have only read it once.
Okay, I've read it many times.
And like, you're right, clearly we have a different idea of what the key part of the book is. But there's just like a turn at the end of the first like chunk, which took my breath away. I remember I like audibly made a sound reading it. Like, it is just so shocking and moving and incredible. And... for me, like, that is the kind of resonating feeling of, like, what this book means to me and why it's on the list for me.
I agree. I've read this book many, many times. I love it. It's the kind of book I will give to people as a gift. I just think it is the... if you like reading books, you will like this book. I think it's, you know... I think it's an almost universal choice.
It wasn't on the list, was it?
I don't know.
It wasn't on the list.
Maybe not. That's so weird.
It's weird, isn't it?
That is weird.
One of those books that I still think of as like a perennial bestseller, but maybe it isn't.
Yeah.
Like, maybe it, like, I've never really seen it on TikTok. I've never really seen like the new kind of literary kind of influencer generation. I've not seen them mention it at all. So maybe it is one that's like slipped into the background for some people.
Well, it shouldn't. Because, yeah, I just think it's incredibly beautiful, incredibly emotional in a way that does not feel like manipulative. It just feels like the truth of human life and how like weird and unfair and long and, you know, changeable that can be. And yes, the sort of the last bit of the novel, which is quite a long chunk, does something really interesting and I think in the context of the rest of the novel quite unexpected. Like, it takes a real turn into a completely different world, and I think that makes it incredibly compelling.
I think it's so funny though, then there's like two wolves within this book, and we both find the one over the other more appealing. And that kind of maybe summarizes why this is the only book that we have on our list.
I agree. So we begin with What I Love by Ciri Husfer. Alice, what is your next pick?
Okay, number two for me is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. This one was on the list, but yes. I did make the decision in making my list that I was going to write it earnestly and not just leave things off because they're already represented.
Yeah, no, because we're not going to list all 100 books. So the point of this episode is to just give our own lists.
Yeah. Exactly, it's personal. Visit from the Goon Squad, a sequel actually came out a year or two ago, maybe 2 years ago, called The Candy House, which I still haven't read, because Goon Squad is just such a good book. I'm almost like, it's too perfect. I don't know if I need more, but of course I want more, and I will read it. So Goon Squad, it's kind of about the music industry, is often how it's described, but it's a series of interconnecting short stories. Every story has at least one character from another story in common. And through this, like, medium, you see this kind of wider picture of this, like, group of people. It's so original, it's really experimental and inventive, and it's one of those books that, for me, the very last story, where you kind of meet the first character again, stunning. Just perfectly plotted, perfectly written, no notes.
I think we did it on the pod a long time ago. I feel like we have... Because I'd read it many, many years ago and then have reread it in the last few years, which I assume was for the pod. Do we have memories of doing
that? I sadly have no memories whatsoever.
Okay, so I will not ask you. But I think if you are a seasoned pod listener, you may have listened to a whole episode of us talking about it. Have you read anything else by Jennifer Egan?
You know, I haven't. I was just saying this to my friend the other day when she was like, I've got like one of her books on my shelf. I've just never read it because Goon Squad's so perfect. Mm. And I was like... Same, and it's the same actually with another author on my list. I'm just like, I've never felt, I think, because Goon Squad is just so original. Nothing else will compare to it. And that's a terrible way to view an incredibly talented writer's career, and I should really read something else, but it will probably be Candy House next.
Mm. So I think, I have only read 2 books by Jennifer Egan. But I think based on how different those 2 books are, I do think she may be a genius.
What's the other one you've read?
So the other one I've read is actually my next submission for my list, which is Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan, which is a historical novel set around the Second World War. Sort of slightly noirish world of sort of gangstery people, but also about a girly who wants to be a diver in the Navy and like work on in like a shipyard in New York on boats. And I cannot make it sound good because none of those things sound good, but like it is so amazing. Like, it is the most absorbing book, and you would never know that she had written A Visit from the Goon Squad. They are so different.
I feel like right now Bethany's face is saying, trust me, bro.
And you're like, I do not trust you.
It's like a trust me, bro expression.
And you're like, no.
Well, no, I mean, this is the thing. I think, like, there are just lots of things in that kind of blurb don't immediately appeal to me. But I love Goon Squad so much. And what do I love about it? Yeah, like, the premise is great, but what I love is the writing.
Yeah. And so, I think that's the vibe, is like, when I found out what Manhattan Beach was about, I was like, oh, that doesn't sound that fun. But my husband had bought it secondhand. He refers to himself as an Eganiac.
For fuck's sake.
He's on the Jennifer Egan hype train. And so I just was like, oh, he said it was good. And he kept wanting to like talk to me about it. And I was like, well, I haven't read it, so I can't. And so I did read it, and it has been life-changing. It's so good. And yes, I do think maybe she is a genius.
I believe you.
She has a Pulitzer. Like, I think she is understood to be a genius.
We'll check in like a year's time, and maybe I would have ticked off some more Egan novels.
Yeah, I think she deserves it. I do think she's a proper banger. What is your next submission, please?
So my next one is actually one of the... I've got quite a few that are pretty contemporary. My list, in fact, skews very
recent,
probably even post-2020, maybe? I don't know, jury's out on that. Some of them actually, I think, are a bit older. Anyway, So my next one is Convenience Store Woman by Sayaka Murata, translated by Ginny
Tapley Takamori.
Thank you so much. I knew that you would have her name on the tip of your tongue because you're so smart. I should have written it down. Anyway, so Convenience Store Woman, I don't really feel like we need to go into it. I feel like at this stage, if you've listened to this pod before or if you're in any way interacting with books on the internet, you have probably come across this book. The reason why I included it on my list is because I think it just, for me, it marked the turn in like this very millennial look on the world of work. Obviously, it's about retail. I think the kind of description of the kind of mindset of being a retail worker and working in a shop that you have immense pride in that has no pride in having you as an employee really resonated with me. It's skirts upon being quite dark without actually going all the way there, and I really loved it. Also, very chic in being a very small book, which I always find pretty cute.
Chic in being a small book, and also chic in being translated.
Yeah, in fact, I think it is my only translated title.
I think I had a translated title and I sacrificed it for something else. So my list is very unchicly all written in English. So you got me there.
I only have one, so I can't even neg you. Okay. I was going to be like, boring, moo, but I can't really do that because I have one book. Like, who do I think I am?
So one thing that I suspect you do not have on your list is nonfiction.
I have two.
Wow, that's more than I've got.
Excuse me. I have two.
Well, you are just the best person in the world and I suck. I'm going to move into my non-fiction submission because I think it's the most recently published book. So if we're going into like recent years, as you did with Convenience Store Woman, I'm going to say what is possibly my most rogue inclusion is The Fact of a Body by Alex Marzano Lesnovich.
You were very moved by that book.
I loved that book.
If I had to guess your top 10 of the 21st century, I would have included that.
I love that about you. So that came out in 2017. I know this because I remember the summer of 2017 very well. It was a very wild time. And I read this book and it really stayed with me. It's a non-fiction book that is sort of half about the author's relationship to their own life and things that happened to them in the past, and half them researching and exploring this historic murder. I just loved it. It really did something exciting and interesting for me formally. I thought the writing was great. I think it's kind of unfortunately forgotten and underrated. So I love to be able to get it back on people's radars. And I've been waiting for a new book by Alex for 7 years now, and it has not been forthcoming. But I assume one day we will meet again.
They're plugging away at something, yeah. I hope. But now that you said that, I wonder when The Red Parts was published, because maybe that's one that I would have considered including. Like, I'm not sure. I think it must have been. No, of course it was post. It's 21st century. Mm. But never mind. I've made my list. I'm sticking to it.
You made your list and you're sticking to it. And like, even though I did, as you know, we sort of discussed our lists before we recorded, like a few days ago, and there were a few that I've had to switch out in favour of proper faves that for various reasons I had forgotten about. That was one that I was like, no, that's The Fact of a Body has to stay. Give me one of your non-fics. I want to hear about some non-fics.
No, because I'm going in alphabetical order.
Oh, I'm going in absolutely no order. I'm going in vibes order.
Okay, I'll do a non-fic. So the first non-fic on my list in alphabetical order is In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado.
Yes.
Have you read it?
I have read it.
Incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible.
Incredible. I feel, again, like it's so experimental, and yet, you know, experimental work, I think, can either be quite challenging to read or can be delightfully easy to read. And although the subject matter isn't easy to read because it is about domestic violence, it is just so wonderfully kind of brought into focus through this medium. I don't even know how would you describe the structure of In the Dream House?
Yeah.
And I was like, I think like it basically like the author examines her own like awful abusive relationship through different literary forms.
Yes.
So each chapter is written in a different style or in a different tradition. And it's just so creative. Like, there's scripts in there. There's a choose-your-own-adventure-style chapter. Like, it's just incredible. And as that, as you slowly kind of read these kind of mosaics of different moments in this kind of the course of this relationship, it's harrowing, but also just such a literary achievement. For me, there was absolutely no doubt it had to be on the list. And there are some other nonfiction books that were not on that list that I expected to see. I'm thinking specifically about The Transgender Issue by Sean Fay, which I don't think is on your list. And Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Renée Edo Lodge. Both of those I was surprised not to see on there. But then when I was constructing my own list, I also didn't include them. So maybe I think sometimes with nonfiction that that can maybe happen. That like, also, I found it strange just lumping fiction and nonfiction together. But then I suppose you could draw arbitrary lines wherever. Like, there's no children's books on the list. I don't know if they were discarded entirely or...
Well, they just didn't ask any... I don't know. Yeah, they didn't ask enough people for that to move the needle. Yeah, and obviously, as I discovered when I was trying to make my own list, before we return to what our own lists are, I found that making my list off the back of the New York Times one meant that I actually missed off initially a couple of like my literal all-time favorite books, because not only were they not on the list, but nothing that reminded me of them was on the list. Whereas, you know, maybe if What I Love by Siri Husvedt wasn't on the list, enough books that were in a similar spirit that made me think, oh, What I Love by Siri Husvedt would be on the list. And like half of my list is by American authors, but way more than half of the New York Times list is by American authors. So I think what then happened with me trying to generate my own list was the things that I had sort of forgotten about were more likely to be by British authors. So I do think that having the list in front of my eyes probably influenced the vibe of things in a way. And maybe that also happened to you. I don't know.
So I actually mostly developed mine by looking at... I've been tracking everything I've read since about 2009. So I just referred back to my reading. So that I think that's also why my list skews post-2010-9-ish. But then I know that previous to 2009, I was at university. And then I was just, like, living my little life. I was reading a lot of, like, horror novels, a lot of goth stuff. I genuinely don't... I think that Sarah Waters is the only author that... I maybe should have included that I'd read in that period for sure that I can think of.
On that note, I included in my top 10 Fingersmith by Sarah Waters.
Such a banger.
Which is in itself such a banger. And I was really surprised. And I do think it speaks to the American bias of the list to not see any Sarah Waters at all on the list. Because I do think, yeah, I think she is a real, like, yeah, a pillar of modern British writing. She's incredibly popular, she's incredibly good, I think has that rare blend of like commercially successful, genuinely a good writer, selling over a long period of time. Does not appear to be a piece of shit. I don't know, seems like a good...
I assume so.
So I chose Fingersmith, and I think you would have liked to have included Fingersmith in your
if
list.
I hadn't already have made my little graphic, which took me a long time on Canva, maybe I would have put Fingersmith in there. Because I do think it's one of the most satisfyingly plotted books I have ever read.
Incredible. I mean, to the extent to which I can tell you where I was when I read the bit in Fingersmith that is the best bit of a book, which is the early pivot that takes place.
I know the bit. You know what I mean. I know the bit.
Pret, Regent Street, 2016. Picture the scene. There I am, minding my own business, reading this book called Fingersmith, and I think I know what's going on. And then you find out you're actually reading a completely different book. And incredible, just incredibly satisfying. And I love it. I just love it.
My only regret with my relationship with Sarah Waters is that I read Tipping the Velvet very soon after Fingersmith, because Fingersmith is just so good. So I immediately read Tipping the Velvet, which is also incredible. And then I read Affinity, and I was like, I feel like I've done too much Sarah Waters in one go, if such a thing exists. And I think it was at a time when I was reading a lot less literary, like, historical fiction. And I just felt a little bit like I overdosed on it. I really do look forward to rereading them with some distance and discovering, you know, more about why I love them so much.
I also think, in my humble opinion, that Fingersmith is the best. So I think to go in with Fingersmith, you sort of leave yourself with nowhere else.
It's like starting with Gone Girl.
Exactly.
Although lots of people like to say Sharp Objects is the better book. I think Gone Girl is more compelling. That's my humble truth.
I do like. I'm a sharp objects girly.
Oh, shit.
I was quite surprised. On that note, I was quite surprised to not see Gone Girl on your list.
I thought about it. I thought about it long and hard, but I had to remember my initial reading experience. So I read Gone Girl in 2012 as a bookseller. And I stand by the fact that although I think it is incredible and it's been so influential to me in my writing, it gets a bit silly.
It gets a bit silly.
There is a moment, this isn't really a spoiler if you haven't read Gone Girl yet, although if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't read Gone Girl,
what is wrong with you?
Give your head a wobble. But anyway, like the moment when we start talking about frozen vomit, I was like, oh, for God, like, and although now that I'm a writer myself, although I was always a writer, you know, now that I'm a published writer myself and I think about the intricacies of plotting a novel like that, I have a better idea as to why, you know, like, we ended up in the realm of frozen vomit, and actually, I forgive the frozen vomit. As a reader in 2012, however, it felt like it just went a little bit too far.
Yeah.
Which the film does not do. No, the film does not,
yeah.
If I recall correctly.
Which is interesting that, like, you were not the only person to identify that as elements that could have been yanked out.
I just tightened a little bit. And, like, who the fuck am I to criticise Gone Girl? But either way, that was my, like, residual feelings having finished it. And I remember that a lot of the time in that time period when I was recommending it to people, like, as a new novel, as a novel that, like, wasn't quite ubiquitously everywhere yet, I quite often had to say, it goes a little bit far, but it's really fun. And for me, a caveat is not what I want when I'm doing my top 10 books of the entire 21st century.
I think that's legit. I just wanted to chat about that. And I'm happy that we got to.
No, listen, I'm an open book, you know?
She is.
So many unspeakable opinions brewing in his brain at all times.
That we're saving for the pub.
Save for the pub, yeah. Okay, is it my turn?
Yeah, my turn.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to my alphabetical order, and I'm going to mention Homegoing by Yaa Gyasi.
Yes, that slapped. Oh. That was 2017 as well, wasn't it?
Yes.
That was a good year for books.
It was such a good year for books. I was working in Waterstones Gower Street, having the time of my life.
Was that the year that the short story salon started?
Yes, it was.
Is that the year that it began with Ellie Williams and Jessie Greengrass?
Yes.
Yeah.
And was there someone else?
Not on that one. It was just those two. Yeah.
What a great time.
What a time.
Oh, and that was my favorite bookshop that I ever worked in. But anyway, Homegoing. Homegoing, in many ways, I always describe as quite similar instructor to A Visit from the Goon Squad. Because actually, it feels like, well, it essentially is, each chapter is its own story. And we bounce between multiple generations of two different families, starting, oh God, I wish I'd done more research reminding myself about the exact nature of the plot, but it's kind of tracking the way that slavery impacts these two different families. It's just so incredible. And although at first I was really struggling in my little brain to remember which character belongs to which family. Mm. Slowly I realised that's kind of not the point, because eventually it becomes clear anyway. Like, you kind of see how these people's lives completely deviate, even though they've all started from the same place. It's incredible. It's such an incredible achievement. And again, that combination of being incredible writing, so well executed and so original. I just loved it.
I think in my nature, I'm quite resistant to multi-generational stories. I think that is, if I had to write like a list of sort of literary turn-offs, that would be one. And I'm so glad that my inherent bias against that did not prevent me from engaging with Homegoing, because it is so good.
I completely agree, because I think themes of family don't really interest me that much. But I'm not necessarily drawn to, like, stories of mothers and daughters or fathers and sons. You know, that doesn't really do it for me. And as soon as you add in multi-generations, you're just doing that but more. Whereas I think thinking of it as a short story collection completely changes the script, you know, like, yeah, incredible.
I loved it. I only have one more on my list that is, oh no, sorry, I've got two more on my list that are American, and then we're fully shifting into the English half. Obviously Fingersmith was, but my next American submission is Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides.
Woo!
Which, all-timer for me, I loved it.
Also a multi-generational novel.
Well, exactly. But that's like, I just feel like there's some times where, even if something on the face of it does not appeal to you. Because Middlesex is a book that I started many times before being able to read it, because I found the opening chapter, which is set in Smyrna, back in the day in the Ottoman Empire, I found that so hard to get into that I like abandoned that book many times.
Interesting.
Before reading it. And then when I actually got into it, I had the time of my life.
I loved Middlesex. I haven't really interacted with much, like, kind of modern conversations about it. Like, what year was it published?
I don't know. But
like,
I
in the 2010s?
Yeah. No, it would have been before that. I would...
No, sorry, I meant pre-2010.
Pre-2010s. Like, yeah. And I do agree that I don't know what the state of the world is now on a cis man writing a story about an intersex person. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
And yet, if we're just making a list of our books, this would be one of my books.
Because, man, Jeffrey Eugenides, like, he can write a fucking sentence.
Yeah.
Like, The Virgin Suicides is one of my all-time favourite books, and if it wasn't written in the late 90s, it would absolutely would have been on my list.
And in the same way as Jennifer Egan, wouldn't you say that, like, The Virgin Suicides and Middlesex are so different that you're like, that's a genius? Like, they don't write... Like, I don't think thematically they exist in, like, the same... They're doing completely different things.
No, I'm gonna... But then, you know, actually, I was gonna disagree with you, but then I haven't read any other Jennifer Egan books, so... But I feel like at the center of Middlesex, ultimately, is a young woman working out who she is and how she fits into this world that she's not quite built for.
But
or rather,
the
world is not
responding,
accommodating
yeah.
to her.
I feel like what actually happens on the page in terms of, like, the content of the book rather than the themes of the book is so different. Like... Virgin Suicides is kind of quite a, like, narrow, zoomed-in
yes.
story.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you look at something like Middlesex, which is such a, like, huge, zoomed-out story that does so many different things. And you're kind of like, oh, I forget that I'm reading fiction. I feel like I'm reading someone's, like, biography.
Yeah,
I can't believe
yeah.
that that's, like, not a real person, that this is the person that some dude has invented. I love it. I truly love it. But, yeah, I would be interested to hear, like, how it has aged politically. But as a book... I stand by it.
Did you ever read The Marriage Plot?
I did, and I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it well enough.
Did it get bad vibes at the time?
I think like it just can't really stand shoulder to shoulder with Virgin Suicides and Middlesex.
Yeah, which is a shame when you have written those books that everything else you write will be judged against those. But I think as a reading experience, I remember really liking it.
I read that in Morocco.
That's a nice place to read.
Chic.
Chic indeed.
A rare chic move from your trash pal.
From the trash host Alice Slater. What's Alice Slater's next submission?
Let me see. Oh, so I have another non-fiction on my list.
Tell me.
I've got Just Kids by Patti Smith.
Oh yeah, you love that.
I love it so much. I love it so, so much. It feels like a deeply meaningful book to me as well. I read it. It was recommended to me by a friend who is no longer with us, who also recommended Goon Squad. My God. Just two books that are so meaningful to me. I finished reading Just Kids on the plane home from visiting this friend in New York. And it was the anniversary of my father's death. And if you've read Just Kids, you know that it is about Patti Smith's relationship with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. And obviously... He died of AIDS. I just was on that flight crying my eyes out. It was just so emotionally resonant. I've probably reread it two or three times. I think I've read the physical book twice since then, and I've also listened to Patti reading the audiobook. Stunning. And I've read everything. I was about to say everything else she's written. She's actually written loads of like poetry books, and you can see my Patti Smith collection just there with the seashells on it.
I can.
I'm obsessed. So, you know, her work kind of meanders between being, like, kind of wacky, like Year of the Monkey, or just as resonant and as beautiful as Just Kids, and I'm here for every word. I love it.
I would like to revisit it. I read it a long, long, long time ago, and I think I would probably enjoy going back there. But isn't it so amazing when, like, a book can feel like it contains, even though it's not by you, it contains so many emotions.
Yeah,
and,
memories
at the right time. It's nice when that
but
happens.
But also it's strange reading this book growing older as well, because, you know, when I read that flight home, I was like 24 25. I'm now 38. I last read it maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and it's still it's resonating with me more and more as I grow older, and I recognize how young they were just They were just kids, man.
They were literally...
They were just kids.
Just kids. Little women.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
So another submission I will throw into the ring was The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. Have you read this book?
I have never read this book.
I loved it. I don't know why I read it. Maybe I read it because I knew that there was going to be an Amazon adaptation coming and I wanted to like have read it before I potentially watched that. And it is sensational. It is so good. Set during slavery, you know, that's not like a fun vibe. But his writing is so gorge, and I have not read anything else by him, but the lovely Elizabeth, who works at Daunt's in Summertown in Oxford, I have a little subscription going with her where she sends me a book every couple of months in exchange for a Daunt's voucher she gave me. So it's kind of insider trading. But she just sent me another book by him, and I'm really excited to read it because I love The Underground Railroad so much. It is very beautiful, very sad, very kind of thrilling, and just has an ending that I found incredibly moving, really like took my breath away.
So am I right in thinking that the whole point of the book is that it's a speculative book that imagines that the Underground Railway was a real railway?
Yeah.
This, just as I'm saying that, I remembered that Goodreads review that was like 1 star. Author's clearly not done a lick of research. The railway was not real. And it's like, bro, that was the whole
grow point. Up. And like, I'm not in my nature like that interested in speculative stuff. But for me, that element of it is so unimportant that I had almost forgotten that that was like part of the plot. Because to me, it is just about like slavery.
I need to read it. I'm going to add it to my list of books that, because I don't know about you, but I found over the last year since we've not been recording, I thought like, oh, maybe it'll take the pressure off. I'll feel less like compelled to focus on frontlist and I'll read more backlist. Have I done that? Have I fuck? I'm still just such a frontlist girly.
Yeah, but you're also in the kind of unfortunate position of that, making that, you know, pivot to not doing the pod and wanting to read more backlist happening at the exact same time that your name is carrying more cachet, so people are sending you more proofs because they want you to blurb them.
True.
So you have like,
because I wrote a book, it's called Death of a Bookseller.
You might have heard of it.
Oh god, the dog just stopped. She was like, stop being cringe, mom.
Mommy. But yeah, I feel like you're doing a lot. You're in your blurbing era.
Yeah, I'm in my blurbing era,
and like the word has got out that you're in your blurbing era, so that's you're true. Only getting sent more front list.
And as you know, it is truly my little passion is to be helpful. I just love to be helpful.
She lives to serve.
As long as I don't have to get up or put a bra on,
then
I'm helpful to you, you know?
So I feel like that makes sense that you have not been reading as backlisty as you wanted to. I get it.
True. Do you want to know what's next on my
Please.
List? It is Lanny by Max Porter.
Yes, I was very interested by this.
Really?
Tell me more.
Oh my god, I love Lanny. I read it twice the year it came out. Have you read it?
Yes.
Okay.
I really liked it.
Yeah.
No,
it's one of those books. I very rarely, in fact, I've even like explicitly said when I'm pitched books to blurb and they have words like warm in the blurb, I'm like, it's going to be a no from me.
Yeah.
Like I'm not really like into books that aim to make me feel warm. Lanny left me feeling, it thawed me. I loved it so much. I loved the creativity on the page. I loved the interaction between the human and the folkloric. I loved this representation of this like English village that steers away from just being totally twee and romanticized.
Yeah.
Like you get these whispers of like conversations from the villagers and they're very realistic, even in their ugliness, in their like kind of anti-outsider, in their pro-Brexit nature. Like it felt like a really truthful rendering of something that's just so often like deeply romanticized, and I loved it. Also, I feel like I was kind of primed to love this book because do you remember at the Faber spring party and Max Porter read a section out?
I do.
And he reads a section where the parents can't find their son Lanny and there's kind of a bit of drama about looking for him. And Max just read it so brilliantly. It was so captivating. It immediately, immediately made me feel so excited to read the book. And it truly delivered for me.
That reading, if I had not been at that event and heard that reading, I would probably never have read the book. But
yeah.
It was like, He's incredible.
Like, he's so talented. Just
and what a good egg as well.
He also loves to be helpful. He's a blabbing king. Loves to lift other authors up.
What a good egg.
Good dude.
A good dude. Max Porter, certified good dude.
Good dude, good book. And I really loved, I did really love Grief is a Thing with Feathers, but I felt like Lanny just, we went from like to love, you know?
Agree. Okay, so while we're in the kind of English countryside, I'm going to submit my next one, which is one that I know you haven't read and I know does not appeal to you in any way, but I really think is one of the best books of all time, is Life After Life by Kay Ackman. Much like I'm not interested in like multi-generational family sagas, something I'm really not interested in at all on the face of it are like time loop stories or having to read the same old shit again and again and again.
Interesting. Are there many time loop narratives in fiction?
I think there's more than maybe you are thinking there are.
Interesting.
Just saying. So Life After Life did not appeal to me for dual reasons. Namely, it is set in the past, which, as we know, can be very boring. Back in the day, often not the one. And also, I just really didn't like the idea of having to read the same shit happening again and again and again. However, one again, much like Middlesex, once I got into it, I was like, okay, so this really is like one of the best books I've ever read. It is the most, one of the most memorably moving books where you just feel so invested in the characters that when you're reading you sort of know which path you're on. And when you're reading one where you know it is going to end in something horrible happening to one of the characters. Yeah, I find between that and A God in Ruins, which is the sequel, which is about the main character of Life After Life, her brother. Maybe just thinking about like old people in the past. Very, very moving. But yeah, I really have a lot of sort of emotion tied up in this book in a way that I was really not expecting to. And I do think Kay Atkinson, again, may be a genius.
Do you think I would like it?
I think if you could get into it, if you could overlook the things that naturally put you off about it, it is amazing, and it is not twee, fundamentally. Like, I think it has this veneer of potentially being a bit sort of, like, twee and mainstreamy, but I thought it was amazing. Truly amazing and deeply, deeply, deeply moving. Next submission, please.
Speaking of the exact opposite of, like, deeply, deeply, deeply moving, I really questioned adding this, and then I had to examine why I was questioning it, and I realized it's purely because it makes me look basic.
Tell me.
I've added My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Atessa Moshfegh.
You have to do what is in your heart. You have to honor what is in your heart.
I hate to be a hipster about it, but I read this book the year it came out, in 2019. I was on my honeymoon in Japan, and it was incredible. I loved it so much immediately. I loved the voice, I loved the vibe, I loved everything about it. Oh, sorry. Just smacked the dog with my phone. Anyway, I loved everything about it. And I think like it has suffered a little bit by becoming so massive that, as with many of these things, like, it's become so popular, it's become a book that's very easy to dismiss for being about this privileged woman who has, I mean, I always see people say that, like, this privileged woman who just decides to like nope out for a bit. She has lost both her parents. Like, it, for me, it's a grief novel, and I think it's spectacular. I love an unsympathetic character. I loved everything that happened in this book. I love how gross it is. I love Atessa Moshfegh. And I felt like I would be doing myself a disservice if I pretended that I didn't read it twice in 1 year. Even though the first time I read it was in the October. I wouldn't be living my truth.
Exactly.
My truth if I skipped
it. You have
it.
To live your truth.
Yeah.
And I think it's right to include it. I would like to revisit it, because when I read it, I loved it. But I always think of Eileen as, like, my favourite Atessa Moshfegh novel. And I would like to revisit My Year of Rest and Relaxation.
I recommend it. Have you reread Eileen?
I haven't reread Eileen, but I watched the film. Which is basically the same.
The same thing.
It is the same thing. The same thing. And I found that the film really held up the story.
I still haven't seen it. I need to sort my life out.
It's the book. It doesn't do anything different. But it's very well cast. And I just think the book is good.
I will say that I think that moment in the book, the turn.
Yes.
Again, no spoilers if you haven't read it, if you're listening. But the turn in that novel. And I say turn because it turned my stomach. Like, I remember I was reading it really late at night. I couldn't sleep. My husband was asleep. No one was awake. I read that moment in that book and I felt this, like, deep, primordial fear be unlocked within me. Like, I don't think anything has quite... And I don't want to, like, over-egg it, because it's not, like, a scary thing. It's just, like, the realization that... That feeling that you have reading that scene, that things aren't quite right, and when you realize that things are not quite right, oof, masterful.
That's almost what I think, you know, we talked about, like, things that turn me off literally, like multi-generational stories or time loops or whatever. And something that I have identified as something that I specifically love is, like, a literary fiction novel that does something fun with genre. I like a fun thing. I like a sort of weird crimey element in my literary fiction. Or an just something kind of unexpected among the literariness.
Yeah, I like dark shit. You just said, like, so many quite interesting, clever things. Or, like, I just quite like dark shit.
I like it when bad things happen.
Yeah, but I like them to happen in a way that's interesting on the page.
And fun.
Fun and beautifully written. That's, like, my... Well, baseline for every book I've picked. The one thing they all have in common is that I think they're beautifully written.
Speaking of literary novels that are also genre and are beautifully written, my next submission is Never Let Me Go by Katsuo Shiguro.
Oh, you love that bitch.
I love that bitch. He is really one of my favourite authors of all time. I have other authors of books that are my favourite books, but I do not have a relationship with, like, their entire body of work. But with him, he is one of my favourite authors of all time, and this is one of my favourite books of all time. And it is a sort of speculative sci-fi novel about a world in which... It kind of is a spoiler, but it's That's so intrinsic thing. To the plot. I do not want to spoileration it if you haven't read it. But it's about a group of three young people who are at a slightly strange school who are being sort of trained to live a specific life for a specific purpose, which becomes more apparent as the book goes on. And I found the book incredibly moving, and I think he is a wonderful writer. And
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it. Have you read Clara and the Sun?
I have.
Did you like it?
I really like Clara and the Sun. I preferred Never Let Me Go.
I really liked Clara and the Sun. I listened to it via audio, which for me is a very different experience to reading on the page. I find that when I'm listening via audio, I am listening more for plot than language, which is why I tend to not read fiction in that way, like via audio. So I feel like I missed quite a lot, and I would quite like to reread it.
Because I do think he is a language writer as well.
Very much so. Yeah. Or even though, like, Never Let Me Go and Clara and the Sun are very accessible in their literariness, he is very much a writer that flexes on the page.
Yes, and I think thematically they are quite similar, but I think I preferred Never Let Me Go because I felt like it was exploring a question that I'm maybe more interested in than what Clara and the Sun was exploring.
Yeah.
And it's a real make-you-think novel in a really good way. Because it makes you feel deeply uncomfortable and unhappy. And you're like, okay, at what cost?
It's like, okay, I'm living. Yeah. This is what I want from my fiction, man. Fuck me up.
So if you've never read it, I really would recommend it. If you want something that will make you feel very unhappy and uncomfortable.
See, that's also one that I read a long time ago. I think I read that in, like, 2005, 2006.
It's an old one.
I read it in hardback. That's how old I am.
I remember when Never Let Me Go came out in hardback. How many more have you got?
I've got two more.
Me too! Yay. What's your next one?
So my next two are actually both literary slash genre. Next on my list, I have Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl by Andrea Lawler.
Tell me everything.
Stunning, incredible, no notes. Just the perfect read for me. So Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl is also kind of a speculative novel. It's about this individual called Paul who can kind of shapeshift to change their gender at will, and it's kind of like a tour around 90s queer America. We go from, like, student parties to leather bars to lesbian music festivals. Like, it is just an incredible, like, education in queer American history of that particular time period, while also being a really great plot. I absolutely loved the character of Paul, and I've never really read anything quite like it. I completely loved it.
I don't think I've read it, which is so wild.
That is very unexpected. Are you sure?
I'm quite sure I haven't read it.
That is so unexpected.
It's really unexpected to me as well, that I'm like, this makes no sense. Maybe the year it came out, I just like had to read other things and we didn't do it for the pod, so I didn't get to it. I don't know. It's nice to have these things.
Stuff to look forward to.
In the future, exactly.
I think you specifically...
I know I will love it.
Will love it. Also, I was really impressed the other day. So my brother and I almost never talk about books because he only reads sci-fi and non-fiction, specifically about politics. And I do not read sci-fi, so like...
And you definitely don't read non-fiction specifically about politics.
I can't.
Because it's boring.
I don't get it. But he shocked me, then he told me that he recently read Politics of Woman, Mortal Girl, because it's, to him, it's sci-fi.
Oh,
it came up and he's
like
looking for something, and he loved it. He thought it was great. And I was like, make you think.
That's so funny.
Because I never would have introduced this book by describing it as speculative, as science fiction. That to me is not like the priority for me is the way that I would describe it. Oh, that was so inarticulate, but you know what I mean? Like, it's not something that like stuck out to
me. Yeah,
yeah. It's not something that drew me to it necessarily. But what drew me to it was the queerness of it. And like, to him, yeah, like he found it through a completely different route entirely. And he thought it slapped.
You and your brother pitching Politics of a Mortal Girl is like me and you pitching Never Let Me Go, where we're both like...
What I Love.
What I Love by Siri Husfer, where we're both like, we will describe the book to you and both will be accurate, but they will be completely different books.
Yeah.
You mentioned how listening to things and reading things can be very different experiences. My penultimate submission is a book I've only ever listened to in audio, but it is probably my favourite audiobook of all time, and I would recommend it to anyone who loves to listen to books with their ear holes. It is Beyond Black by Hilary Mantel.
I knew it was going to be that. I was like, I must know the answer to
You do know the answer. And I think, semi-interestingly, I have never been able to get into any other Hilary Mantel, whether I've tried to read it with my eyeballs or my ear holes. Like, she is not an author that I have a bond with in any way. And yet, Beyond Black, I think, is incredible, which is the story of a medium and her assistant who are sort of touring venues around, you know, the kind of greater London area in the maybe like late 90s, early noughties. And they have this very difficult relationship, and it's about them and the kind of people they encounter and the venues they play at. And I loved it.
I really need to read it.
I think you would enjoy.
I know. Sadly, I was meant to go on holiday to Harnia this year, and I'd brought it with me to be...
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I did not get to go to Harnia, because it turns out they don't let you fly if you don't have a valid passport.
You have a valid passport. Alice, you are valid. It is Brexit that is invalid.
I know,
Do not blame yourself.
Let this just be my PSA to listeners. If you're travelling to the EU... Of which Greece is a member... I know that you probably know to check when your passport expires. You know that you have to have a minimum of 3 months to 6 months, depending on the country, to travel. But did you also know that you need to check the issue date? Because if your passport was issued over 10 years ago, even if it is still valid, it is not valid to travel in the EU. I did not know that. I did not get to travel. And I know, as I'm saying this, you're probably thinking, no, I already knew that. I feel like you probably misunderstood me. Go and Google it. Just double check.
Check your passport before you go on holiday.
Because I met with my mom the other day. I told her the story and she was like, yeah, that's really awful. And then my brother pulls up a photograph of her passport on his phone. She had the same problem. She didn't even know. She's about to fly.
Okay, that's wild.
She had time to fix it. But she didn't. I told her the story, but she just cognitively just heard one thing and understood it to mean the expiry date.
You are going to save the life of a What Page Are You On listener
saving
today.
Saving holidays.
You are saving holidays left and right.
Left, right, centre.
But obviously the worst fallout of this experience was that you have not got to read Beyond Black over the last
week.
And
now I never will, because it's tainted. No, that's not true. I will read it.
You are literally doing the same holiday you were going to do in a couple of months' time.
Yeah,
where you will and can take Beyond Black. So that you have read it in time for spooky season, where we're all thinking about ghosts and ghouls.
Perfect. No, I will. It's on my list. I know. I also have never read any Hilary Mantel. This is primarily because... I will say, I know everyone has said that Wolf Hall is incredible. It, to me, it just looks like a snooze fest. I'm sorry. It looks like a snooze fest. It's really fucking long. It's got 1,000 different people in it.
They're all called Thomas.
They're all called Thomas.
You won't know who anyone is.
I don't have time. I don't have time to read a book where I don't know anyone is. unless it is picking apart the family tree in the book Homegoing. Because the whole point of that is you can accept that it doesn't matter, you will figure it out. Whereas with Wolf Hall, I feel like it will be a distraction.
I listened to 8 hours of the Wolf Hall audiobook and then did something else and just realised I could not go back in.
You did 8 hours of 500 hours. Yeah. You barely scratched
the surface. I literally barely scratched the surface. So yeah, Hilary Mantel is not necessarily the one for me. I have read one other book by her, which I liked. I cannot remember the name of it, but it was about a family who had spent time in Africa and were now back in the UK. I liked that, but Beyond Black, truly exceptional.
She was a very prolific writer, wasn't she?
She was.
Has a huge back catalogue.
And a range.
Yeah. Maybe, I feel like maybe my Wolf Hall era will come in like 10 years' time. Maybe I'll be like, it's time, I'm ready. I've got into my history, I'm a Tudor bitch now. Maybe then it will be like, it will come into focus and I'll be ready.
Sounds fake, but okay. But I did find Beyond Black to be very accessible. So, you know, if you have been like, I'd like to experiment with Hilary Mantel, but the Wolf Hall cinematic universe seems like too much of a responsibility for me, give Beyond Black a go, because I think it is amazing. And I thought the audiobook even more amazing. Final submission, my friend?
Final one for me is one that was on the NYT list. It is a dystopian novel, and it is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
Gorgeous book.
Just, so I remember, I feel like every time that I name a book, I'm then like, story time with Al.
Picture the scene.
Back in the day to my heady years as a bookseller. But I remember it was Book of the Month, and we sold so many copies. And I was like, sure, I didn't read it.
Because why would you? It's sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, I actually do quite like, I liked post-apocalyptic fiction back then, but I just didn't pick it up. But I remember a colleague saying, you can recommend this book to literally any customer, and even if it's not to their taste, they will know someone who they will buy it for. And it was so true. It just sold so easily. It was an absolute dream. And when I finally read it, I was like, fuck me. It is so good. It has so many different angles to appeal to different types of readers. It truly simultaneously horrified me and moved me. It's so impeccably plotted, beautifully written. It just delivered everything I want from a banging read.
And it just, as you said, it like does so much. It is so dense and rich with detail. It's truly amazing, truly beautiful. And I would, if I had had like a top 15, that would have been in there. But I will say, I read, what was the last one that she did? The Sea of Tranquility?
Yes.
I read that last year, I think, or the year before, and that was one of my books of the year. And was plotted in a, you know, where you're just reading and you're loving life, and then everything sort of comes together in an incredibly beautiful way by the end. And I think she's got it.
I need to read The Sea of Tranquility. I just admire that ability to plot so much, because I find plotting so hard. Like, all of my plotting is just a wish and a prayer.
Yeah.
Whereas she has that uncanny knack of making the reader follow, like, remember the things that are important.
Yeah, with such a light touch.
Yeah, with such a light touch, so you don't feel like you're being bonked over the head with, like, clues and hints and don't forget this and signposts. Like, it just, everything flows so smoothly until, it's almost like dominoes, everything falls until the final domino lands and you see the bigger picture. It's just incredible.
And I think maybe her ability to do that stems from the fact that she creates these incredibly vivid images, or like she's just got such a way of making everything feel so real that it makes these moments really memorable without her having to signpost them very explicitly.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You're truly in the zone with her. But yeah, I thought Sea of Tranquility was so gorge and a true, like, in the spirit of Station 11. I think if you like Station 11, Sea of Tranquility, obvious choice. Okay, my final choice, which was not at all on the list, not at all on the New York Times top 100 books of the 21st century list, which kind of shocked me, but maybe I'm the only person in the world that thinks this is one of the best books ever written. It is my all-time favourite novel, The Crimson Petal and the White by Michelle Faber, which is the only 800-page book I've ever read that I wish was longer.
Oh my God.
It is so good. It is a modern day, as we know, because it is written in the 21st century, a pastiche of a Victorian novel. And it is about a brief period in the life of a sex worker in Victorian London called Sugar, who, and the people that she encounters when she falls into the orbit of a client of hers called William Rackham, who is a rich man, and he sort of takes her under his wing for a while in her young life. And it is so funny, it is so naughty, it is very moving, and it just has this incredible ability to make you feel like you are inside the lives of these people. And it is so wonderful. And do not be deterred by the fact it is long, because it is so unboring. I cannot stress enough how juicy and naughty and weird and fun it is.
You know what I think is so funny, though? That when I read Crimson Petal, it was like, I reckon 2004 to 2006-ish, 7-ish, somewhere around that period. And I did not even blink at the length. I didn't think anything of the length. I didn't consider book length when choosing what to read. And I don't know what has happened that suddenly now that's like a caveat that I feel like I need to give when I'm recommending books. Even I mentioned that like Convenience Store Woman is chic because it's like a really small book, like it's really short. Where has that come from within us? Why do we do that?
Come on. It's the attention economy, man. We have no attention span. That's why. That's what's happened since you read it. It's like
we're all on our phones. But I feel like a longer book, you're in there for longer. Like there's a reason why like a lot of readers don't like short stories, because they find it exhausting to be stepping into a new world with each story, that like you're having to start all over again with figuring things out, orienting yourself, getting to know characters. So in theory, in the attention economy, a longer book, something which you're in for longer, which requires less initial kind of
outlay.
Yeah. You would think that
it would appeal. Yeah. I don't know, man. Also, I think, you know, when we're in the world of like book content creation, where that's kind of gamified, like the number of books you are reading and like the ability to read so many books is like rewarded somehow, that like, yeah, I don't know, maybe
it's
that's
really
something
that I try and reject, though, because I don't think it makes me a more prolific reader to worry about how many books I'm reading, if that makes sense. Like, I think like ultimately a really banging book you will get through quicker, regardless of how long it is, because you can't leave it alone. You're always thinking about it. You find opportunities to read it. A dull book, even if it's really short, like, for example, it took me so long to read The Turn of the Screw. Snooze fest. I hate it. I hate Henry James.
Just watch the film.
Every single sentence is about 300 words long, and by the time I get to the end of the sentence,
you're out.
I can't remember where we started. I just find it really dull. But it's a really short book, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Whereas this is a long book, and it could have been longer.
And every single sentence is like a treat.
It is such a treat. That's the thing. When you're reading it, you're like, I am having the time of my life. Like, he is such a masterful writer. The characterization is incredible. This evocation of Victorian, a side of Victorian England that you cannot get from Victorian novels because of like propriety and like the kind of things that were published. So to get to see this part of Victorian London that definitely existed, like there were 100% sex workers in Victorian London and they were going about their lives
pretty famously.
That was like a
pretty well documented
but not like from their point of view, which obviously this isn't, but you know, because it is a contemporary imagining, but like it really, I feel like it gives you something that other books may not have given you about life in Victorian England. And it is so fun, and I think fun is underrated in literary fiction, and this is the best blend of like fun and unbelievable writing that I can imagine. I've done it on audio, I've done it in writings, and it is amazing. And I actually think, if I'm not mistaken, the narrator of Beyond Black on audio is the same narrator as Crimson Petal and the White on audio, and they are two all-timers for me. So well done, that lady.
Good shit.
I think her name's Jill. Well done, Jill.
Good for her.
So that is my list. Shall we just name the books so that if people want them, they have them all in one place? We will put this in visual form somewhere on our social media, i.e. Instagram. So my list was, this is in no order other than that this is the order I wrote it down in. The Fact of a Body by Alex Marzano Lesnovich. What I Loved by Siri Husfer. Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan. Beyond Black by Hilary Mantel. Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. The Crimson Petal and the White by Michelle Faber. Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, Never Let Me Go by Katsuo Ishiguro, and Life After Life by Kate Atkinson. Alice, what is your list?
My list is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, Convenience Store Woman by Sayaka Murata, Homegoing by Yagi Yassi, In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado, Just Kids by Patti Smith, Lanny by Max Porter, My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Mushbeg, Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl by Andrea Lawler, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, and What I Loved by Siri Husvet.
Gorgeous.
Gorgina.
Thank you so much for joining us. We will be back.
In the meantime, you can find us on social media at WhatPagePod. And if you enjoyed listening to our great return, maybe give us a little share, give us a follow, send us some love.
Yeah, incentivize us to keep recording episodes. Why don't you?
Yeah, your attention is like a little cookie.
Yeah. Speaking of which, we are hungry and we need a cookie.
We're going to eat some cookies now. Bye. Bye.